welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country by the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, today, we've got a couple of things happening. First up, we're talking to one of my daughters, Mundanara, is involved with in a particular program at the moment with a group of people in the community. Then we're talking to Les Melzer soon after that. He's co-chair of Congress, National Congress for Australia's First Peoples. Mundanara, welcome to the program. How are you?
Good morning, Dad. I'm good, thank you.
How are you? Good. I'm well. Now tell us, you're involved in a program to do with fitness and weight loss and stuff. What is it?
Yeah. Basically, the program's called Warrior at War. It seems a little bit kind of violent.
Yes.
But it's not at all.
Confrontationalist.
It is one of the deadliest initiatives I've ever heard of, because my background studying naturopathy and nutrition and being at the institute where I set up that school-based traineeship program with those allied health assistants from the Murray School, it was all around nutrition. And
well, tell us about the program. What
yeah,
is it?
Well, to actually get to this program and see that we could actually have 12 or 13 Murrays do a weight loss kind of competition like The Biggest Loser, but without all the screaming and yelling, talking to our mob normally and encouraging us and motivating us in a very positive manner, has been probably one of the, you know, something that I've really enjoyed in terms of coming back every day. So 3 days a week, we meet up over at Deception Bay at a gym. We do personal training sessions with Kolka and another lady called Sharon. And our other mentor there is Rhonda Purcell, and, you know, sister girl Rhonda is a bodybuilder. She comes and trains with us as well at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and that kind of wakes me up. It gets me out of bed with my little ones to get over to the north side of town. So I live at Carina, and I'm the only one on the south side, as well as a T.I. Falamuki, that come from that side of town to get to Deception Bay for the program. So there's 13 of us. 31 Digital. Is it 31 Digital? Yep. The old Briz
TV,
31.
Briz 31 TV.
Them fellas have been they've been a part of the journey from the start and recording it. So it will be obviously a TV series. So everybody in the community can actually get to see the program and all of our personal journeys.
How long's the program?
It goes for 12 weeks. So we're into our fourth week now.
Almost halfway through.
We're almost halfway through, and I'll tell you one thing, Dad. My first training session, after having two kids, I got a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old. My first session into the gym after a year off, I was about 10 minutes into my session, and I started seeing stars. And we were only doing circuit training. There's six of us, and we're just kind of not really intense. But cut a long story short, I basically hit the ground. I had to lay down. And about 45 minutes, I was laying on the ground resting, and I still couldn't string a sentence together after 45 minutes of no movement.
Bit scary.
So my heart was all over the place. My pulse, they couldn't, you know, it was pretty full on. They rang the ambulance, and all of a sudden I was getting carried out on a stretcher. And I started crying, you know, because I thought to myself, you know, Granny Mook had a heart problem. And for the first time in my life, I started to think, you know, am I going down that track of being overweight, obese and, you know, chronic disease?
So what was it, just pushing yourself a bit too hard?
I did. I went too hard. My body went into shock and had no idea what was going on. And I spent the night at Redcliffe Hospital with all those cords on me for the ECG,
all
the monitor.
Mm.
So I think that was the turning point. That was my first session. I went too hard. I now train with a little Fitbit on my wrist and monitors my heart. I've got my little steps counting every day. But in 4 weeks, I lost 6 kilos. And in the first 11 days, I measured myself, and just around my waistline, I'd lost 6 centimetres.
Wow.
So if they're not good results, you know, and that doesn't work, then what does? And I think that the best thing about the program is he's put us on a type 2 diabetes meal plan. And that type 2 diabetes meal plan is basically no sugar and no wheat. And if all of our mob could stick to something like that, even if it's one meal a day with no sugar and no wheat, you feel so much more energised and so much more lighter. And also clearer, my head feels a lot more clearer. So I'd done a workshop all day yesterday, got home to the kids, I was exhausted, and then still knew I had to get to D-Bay by 6:30 to do a personal training session, which at any other gym I would have cancelled and postponed. So I think being a part of this group with the mob in our community and a lot of deadly women in this program and Sister Girl Rhonda, it inspires someone like myself to actually want to make a change for myself.
Is it only women or there's men too?
No, there's three males in the program, but right. Yeah, there's eight women or nine women and three males.
Mm-hmm.
And looked at, everyone has their own stories of why they got so overweight, why they haven't been able to shift it. And I know another sister girl was talking about her mother and the trauma of losing her mum. And I never thought of trauma as being a cause to my weight gain. I thought it was just having kids. So you get to deal with all those other issues and emotions along the road. So it's been quite interesting. And Dad, 12 weeks, I've got 8 weeks to go. And my goal, I was 104. Now, I've never told anyone my weight. Now, here I am telling people on the radio. I started at 104. I'm down to 98. And my first goal was to get down to double digits again. I've never been 100 kilos in my life.
4 weeks, you're there.
So 4 weeks, I got to my first goal. Now my second goal, I guess, I said if I can get, you know, another 10 kilos off in the next 4 weeks and take it easy, I'll be happy with myself.
All right. Sounds good. Sounds good. And a community-driven, community-based program too is certainly good. We're almost out of time.
That's all right. I'll just say hello to Paula. And
yeah.
Paula, you just quickly tell Dad about your weight loss in the last 4 weeks.
Well, how you going, Uncle?
Good day. What's your name?
My name's Paula Delaney Nazarski. My mob are from Quandamooka Country, North Stradbroke Island there. Yeah, well.
What are your thoughts on the program? How's it working for you?
Oh, I'm Kalka's problem child.
Well, we all got to have a problem child. I've got nine of them. I've got nine of them.
Hey, look out. Yeah, no, I'm the problem child. I'm the one that will argue and complain and fight about the diet. But the one thing I do is just show up because, you know, like my mob, they got bad hearts and kidney disease on my mother's side, you know. So I want to have a good life and I want to have a long life and I want to be a healthy black woman, you know? Yeah.
Good one. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And the support around the program and stuff is good.
It's deadly. Like, even the, you know, like each participant, like we do these emotional diaries and, you know, we film ourselves on our camera phones talking about, you know, if we're having a bad day or, you know, like we might be struggling with food. And that, and we get on there and we watch each other's emotional diaries. And then when we catch up with each other on a Saturday when we do the group sessions, it's like family. It's like coming home to your family. And that, we're a bit dysfunctional, you know, because we're all a bit corked up, you know, how black fellas get.
Mm.
And that, and there's a lot of us women there and we're, you know, we're strong in spirit.
Are those three men keeping up with us, the women?
Well, you kind of feel sorry for them, brothers, eh? I'm not going to lie.
Good on you. Keep the pressure on.
Dad, having that Facebook, I think, has been key to that connection because we're all got our lives, we've all got kids, we've got families, we've got jobs, we've got work, and that Facebook is bringing us together where we can all keep up with each other. Yeah. Instead of being locked in some big house with that Biggest Loser kind of style and not seeing your family and leaving your work and commitments, that couldn't happen.
No.
So to be able to still maintain our commitments every day with our family and work, get on Facebook, see each other, motivate each other, inspire each other, you know, you can't. Like I haven't even thought about, you know, throwing in the towel as hard as it gets.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think about that probably 100 times in a day.
Yeah, yeah.
Like because You know, there's a part of me that's like super lazy and likes being fat, you know, because, you know, when you're fat, you know.
You don't have to worry about nothing. No, give me more of this. Give me more of that.
Yeah, you know, but I have to say since, you know, the weight's starting, my shape is starting to change, you know, because what Colco puts us through, you know, with our body transformation is your kilos might not come off straight away, but your shape starts to change. And there, my husband, mm-mm.
How much weight have you lost? Have you weighed yourself lately?
I have. I haven't actually lost too much. Probably, you know, a kilo or two.
Yeah.
But my shape, yeah. Right. Like my belly, you know, like
good it.
Yeah, instead of looking like I'm 5 months pregnant,
yep.
I reckon I've gone down to maybe 2 months.
Right.
Yeah, because, yeah, you know, family reunions, being a big woman, like them young ones that haven't seen you for a while,
yep.
What I used to do is put my hand on my lower back and put my other hand on my belly, you know, gamma make out, and all of a sudden them young ones come, oh, auntie, you want a cup of tea? Oh, auntie, I'd love a cup of tea, but can you get me some cake too?
It's deadly,
well,
Dad.
It's only 4 weeks in and you're sounding pretty happy with things. We'll have to get you back in 4 weeks and do another chat, catch up.
Of course.
And then at the end of it all, we'll do another catch-up then.
We'll do, yeah.
I'm sure there's a couple more in the program that'd be loved to come in here, Dad.
Yeah, get a few of yous in.
Yeah, well, a few of us are starting to come out of our shells now. Well, not me, because I'm not shame.
Well, you might be joining Rhonda soon, travelling overseas and doing that bikini and doing that business now.
Well, you know she's my cousin, eh?
Yeah.
And she was the one way back when that told me, sissy, pat me on the belly, you know, that's not healthy. And it's true, you know, she's my big sister, you know, doing what I was told. And
they have access to someone like Auntie Rhonda, you know.
Yeah.
She's there for us. She's in that chat room with us on Facebook. She's there on that Saturday training with us, you know. And thank you very much, Sister Rhonda, because I know that you're one person I look up to, and to have you a part of as a strong Murray woman, it definitely motivates me.
Yeah, she Miss Olympia, you know.
Yeah.
Gold medalist.
Well, got to get her, and she'll have to come in with on the next visit as well. Probably might be a separate yarn, but either way.
Yeah.
We'll have to get going.
Too deadly, Dad.
No worries.
Sorry it's a bit short on time today, but...
Sorry we got here a bit late with the traffic. It was a bit crazy.
You can't always judge that. But we'll get you in another 4 weeks. Give you 4 weeks. You're done 4 weeks. Get you back and then... tell us some more yarns. How yous are going?
No worries. I'll tell you about my husband chasing me around the living room.
Deadly. Lose more weight that way.
Hey.
All right, then. Well, thanks a lot for coming in, eh?
No worries.
You just have a good one.
You too.
Thank you.
Well, we'll hear more about that that program in time to come, that's for sure. Stick around because my next guest is Les Melzer. Les is the co-chair of the National Congress for Australia's First Peoples. In the meantime, we've got a song by. Oh, we've got a couple of short messages here that we can run now. Health messages and different things. So stick around, and we'll be talking to Les Mel to get some updates on the national situation with Congress and some of the issues affecting First Nations people. Welcome back to Let's Talk. We're now joined by Les Melzer talking to me from Sydney. Les, welcome to the program. Les is the co-chair of the National Congress for Australia's First Peoples. Welcome to the program, Les. How are you?
Good, thanks, Tiger. Good to be back on your program.
Yes, we haven't spoken for a while, and it's good to have you here.
Yes.
Tell us your mob.
Into the new year.
Yes, first one for the new year. Tell us your mob, your country.
Yes, I'm from the Gubbi Gubbi Butchala peoples up in southeast Queensland, Mary River, Fraser Island region.
All right. Now, you got an update on the constitutional reform. I get the impression that people are starting to get a little bit, starting to wonder what's going on and getting a little bit toey about the referendum and the fact that there's not a body of words that's been put up in front of us to consider. We don't know what's going on. You got an update for us?
Yes. What's happening is the legislation which set up this Parliamentary Select Committee on Constitutional Reform, the deadline was the 30th of June. So the committee is due to report then back to the government. But as we understand, they may actually report a bit earlier on that. They've put out two interim reports, an interim report and then a progress report. And we appeared before that committee last week. And as we were preparing to go before the committee, we thought, well, what has the update on the information that we've submitted there previously? We've pointed out pretty strongly that Congress supports the recommendations made by the expert panel, that they will be beneficial and that they should go ahead. But this time we thought we will make it clear to them that we are concerned that more and more people are saying that they're getting fed up with the way the government's treating them, and that they're going to vote against the constitutional reform. They don't care what it says. Now, we relayed that to the committee. We said that it's very hard to go out and talk to our mob about improving things through constitution and a referendum when the government of the day is going around and putting out negative actions and negative policies to our people. And we mentioned things in there that there's the long-term thing about continuing stolen generations, about high rate of imprisonment of our people and lack of accountability by police when there are killings of our people, high unemployment, etc., etc. These are long-term continuing things that are still around and are likely to be around even if a referendum was successful. And also, with this government, just in the term of this government, cutting half a billion dollars off our budget, holding up funding to organisations while they try and revamp the funding arrangements with the communities, making other announcements which are not supported by the community or unknown by the community, and so on. And that we're saying there's a backlash developing out there, and that it's very hard to get people to say you should support a constitutional reform when they believe that this government is attacking all their freedoms and all their interests.
Yes, that's what that's the feeling I get. I mean, how can you take a government seriously and treat them with respect when, for example, the Western Australian government making threats to close $150 million, to close 150 communities?
Yes.
After the feds have offered the Western Australian government $90 million, a one-off payment, for the infrastructure on those communities, then the Western Australian government saying, no, thanks, we need more money than that, or whatever. I don't know what they're saying, but it seems to be calling the state government in WA, calling the feds bluff and saying, well, we'll just close these communities down. That sort of stuff, Les, isn't real good. Doesn't go towards getting people to take the government seriously and be in discussions for constitutional reform.
Yes, this is a continuing threat. It started before the Northern Territory, for example, were threatening to close down homelands to move Aboriginal people into key centres in the Northern Territory, and there was a big policy backlash about that, and as a consequence, I think the government has changed now its position on that. But what's happened is the Commonwealth has written to all the states' territories saying, we're handing over responsibility to you for housing and infrastructure in these communities, and here's an amount of money, different for each of the states and territories, which will fund you for 2 years, but after that time, you've got to take this responsibility on yourself. And that's what the West Australian government is playing politics about. Excuse me a second. I've got a bit of a cold in my throat there, Tiger. South Australia also made murmurs, and we were hearing also similar things coming from some other states. So we wrote to the Prime Minister as Congress and said, Prime Minister, the Commonwealth Government has the primary responsibility to ensure that our peoples can survive well on our lands and territories. The Prime Minister has written back saying that the government is transferring these responsibilities to the states and territories, and we haven't written back yet to that, but we're going to point out again that it is part of an international obligation to protect the rights of Indigenous peoples that the Commonwealth must take primary responsibility for. And you might recall that this is something that's constitutional as well. We thought in 1967 that the Commonwealth government was to take the primary responsibilities for Aboriginal affairs, and Whitlam made sure of that when he came into power in 1972. But I think mainly the Howard government has tried to reverse that whole process by moving all the responsibility back to states and territories, and that's just not on, because we found before 1972 that every state and territory recognised Aboriginal people having different rights depending on where they were, of course not respecting all the rights fully, but treating us differently depending on which state territory we were in, and we're not going to go back to that situation.
So it's another example of the political football, blacks being the political football, and being caught up in the middle of this these politics between the feds and the state.
Yes, and in fact, the Premier of Western Australia took the first free kick of that political football, because I don't think he was serious about his threat, but he was certainly putting it out there in the public agenda that unless the Commonwealth gave more money, they were not going to provide services to these communities. And as you said, it's now just a political football. I wonder if anyone is listening to what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are saying and wanting about our rights, or whether this is just going to be, a game between the Prime Minister and the Premier in the media.
Well, last year, September, there was a World Conference on Indigenous Peoples. Is there any outcomes that you can report on that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I'm realising now as we're moving into 2015 that not much information has come into Australia about that World Conference, and people haven't really seen much about the results of it. But let me first make this statement that the General Assembly, this was a meeting of the General Assembly, the World Conference, passed a resolution which is as significant as in 2007 when they adopted the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And this resolution is now called the Outcome Document from the World Conference on Indigenous Peoples. And it's a resolution consisting of 40 paragraphs, and each of those paragraphs pertains to an action that will either be taken by the United Nations or by the member states of the UN. And it was adopted by consensus on the 22nd of September 2014, including Australia. Australia was there represented by Julie Bishop at the time, and she made a statement during the World Conference in support of the rights of Indigenous peoples. We are now locked into negotiations with the government about what they're going to do about each one of those actions that are contained in that resolution. Now, these are significant actions. So let me give you an example. Basically, it said we, as the member states, will commit ourselves to recognising free, prior, informed consent in our policies, in our legislation, in our actions, and so on. So that's a big, significant one. But it also says we will establish mechanisms to fairly adjudicate disputes between Indigenous peoples and the states over lands, territories and resources. Again, a fairly significant action to commit to. So there's a number of actions in there. We want to look at them one by one with the government, or not one at a time, but individually at each of those actions and say, well, what are we going to do about that? Can we get agreement about what's the appropriate action? We don't expect that the state will readily agree to everything that we think that they should be doing, but we're in negotiation, and we'll see how far we're able to go in getting that to happen. And it's important that Australia does look positive in this, because they are relying more and more upon their standing at the United Nations. I think next year they're going to apply to become a member on the Human Rights Council, and they've just come off the Security Council and so on. So, we're going to hold them to their record and really get past this sort of backwater policies that the government's been running at us over the recent two decades.
Les, you said that Australia wants to get on the United Nations Human Rights Council. I mean, for crying out loud, with the human rights record that Australia has, particularly First Nations people, particularly children behind razor wire, being the asylum seeker children, and then asylum seekers themselves, how they're treated, have these people got no shame at all?
Well, well, it's interesting, Tiger, because the difficulty we face about attacking Australia on the international scene is that every country has got its own bad record. Now, for example, our neighbour Indonesia's about talking about execution of two Australians, and so they still have the death penalty, for example. So that's a human rights issue, and you've got these wars going on in Syria, in Afghanistan, you know, there's the ISIS crisis and so on happening around. So there are things going on everywhere which can take attention away from how badly Australia's behaving. But let me add in there that we're not aware of any other country in the world that has a constitution that says that the state can discriminate against a race of people. And that's what we've got in Australia at the moment, a constitution that's got provision in there for racial discrimination. We've also got high court decisions saying that the parliament can discriminate. It's not bound by the constitutional law to not discriminate. They can discriminate if it's the will of the parliament, etc. So that will come as a shock, I think, to many of the countries, and we'll be rolling that one out. Australia actually has to appear before the Human Rights Council in November this year on its human rights performance in the last 4.5 years since it last appeared before the Human Rights Council. So we're preparing documentation on that now.
All right. What can you report in regards to creating parity, the Twiggy Forest Review? Do you know anything where that's at, whether recommendations are being implemented or plan to be implemented?
At this stage, we don't have much information. We were very concerned about the review being undertaken at all by Twiggy Forrest. We don't think Twiggy Forrest has got standing. We don't think he's in a position to be able to provide objectivity or perspective on the report. It's a bit of a surprise move to put the wealthiest man in Australia in charge of fixing up the problem for Aboriginal people, and also given that Twiggy Forrest promised 50,000 jobs, but as we look back on that promise now, 3 or 4 years later, nothing has happened, and in fact, the employment rate has gone backwards. So we're cynical about the report being done anyway. We noted the recommendations. We were alarmed at many of the ones that were in there, and there were some in there that we thought were positive. We were talking about a bigger effort for economic development. When we saw newspaper reports a couple of weeks ago that all the recommendations bar one are about to be implemented, we immediately started contacting government to find out what's going on. Now, we're going to Canberra later this week, and we'll be having meetings with the government, and our purpose will be to say, where are you with this report? What are the recommendations you're going to go with? And once we have that information, we're then going to react and respond to the recommendations that the government is entertaining. But we don't want to be tilting at windmills. We don't want to be making a whole lot of criticisms when, in fact, there's no fact to what's going on. So at this stage, we just want the government to give us a clear report of what they're doing. We're against the healthy welfare card. Unless it's a policy, a national policy for all Australians, we've made it clear that targeting our people with these experimental type approaches to welfare, and particularly controlling type, where our people lose their freedoms, our people can't develop as families, they can't manage their own budgets and so on because of government control, then we'll be objecting strongly.
All right. Yeah, that healthy welfare card certainly sounds rather scary, doesn't it?
Well, I just wish they would stop using these euphemisms for names, you know, because there's nothing healthy about it. There's nothing welfare about it. It is a form of control. It's the same as having to wear an armband and identifying yourself, having to walk around with this green card into supermarkets to try and buy your goods.
It's certainly a backward step, back to ration days and mission managers and control and stuff like that. And it hasn't worked in the past, so why would it work now?
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because most of the government members and most of the public know nothing of that history, don't know of that past and how bad it was.
Yes, that is. Most certainly, that certainly is a problem when people don't know the history. But our mob certainly do. We've lived with it.
Yes, that's right. And suffered because of it.
That's right. Yes, yes. The and there's this terminology they use on creating parity, the title of that report, Indigenous Advancement Strategy, is another one where the funding structures have changed around and stuff like that with the funding, the Indigenous Advancement Strategies. What do you know about that? That's causing some anxiety across the country with a lot of our mob.
Yes, it is. And even just at the early stages when it gets discussed in the media, our people panic because we know what comes after that. You know, it's the first indication that there is something about a storm about to hit. And that causes a lot of unnecessary stress. And, you know, stress in our community is a big part of the poor health, the shortness of life and so on. And it's just so silly to have policymakers in Canberra sitting there without any contact with communities or any understanding of the situations that they're creating, rolling out one experiment every time the government changes, you know, a new experiment, new euphemisms, but behind those euphemisms are in fact controlling ivory tower type policies.
What's the future of Congress? How's Congress faring, membership-wise, dollar-wise? Just being able to operate under the restraints and the budget cuts that's been put upon you by the federal government.
Yes, well, the situation there was, of course, that we were only funded until June of last year, and the government told us in Christmas 2013 that they weren't going to release the $15 million for 3 years promised by the ALP government to us. We have rationed our expenditure and we're kicking along fine. We're still able to function and we're certainly as effective as we have ever been in terms of being able to stand up for people's rights and keep the government reminded of its obligations to act without discrimination and to act fairly. However, for us to continue to operate into the future, we do have to get income from funds. We're structuring our strategies to raise funds to bring it in. We haven't really opened up our strategies yet on that, but we've already got the fund established. We've already got all our licenses to raise funds and our tax deductibility status to make all that happen. And we just have to hit the campaign trail. And that will be the same campaign trail that we'll do to again increase our membership. Our membership is still sitting on 8,000 plus members. That is a good number, but we want to see it increasing it to even more to get people to, I think, to take ownership and engage themselves about what Congress is doing. So rather than sitting back and waiting to see what Congress will do next and so on, we want people to say, well, this is me. I want to get out there. I want to join the Congress push and make these things happen and so on. So we're working on strategies for 2015, which will push these things along. At the end of the year, we are due to have our elections, particularly for the two co-chairs, and we want to see a good rollout at that time for those elections to see that voters do support and are going to help Congress continue on. We are trying to work it so that the incoming board at the end of this year will have enough leeway to continue to operate for at least another 12 months before they have to then act on their own resources to get the income in and get the membership coming in. So that's a pretty good assessment for considering the way in which we were had our funds slashed just over a year ago. The other thing which is really good is we've got a very good international reputation. We're seen as being one of the organisations that is making most advances at the United Nations level in terms of pushing rights and so on. And I don't know if I've said it on your program, but last year I was invited to go and work with the President of the General Assembly for that World Conference on Indigenous Peoples. And I spent 3 months doing that in New York to help get those resolutions adopted by all the member states and so on for all that. So that lifted Congress's reputation up in the United Nations, but also amongst other Indigenous peoples around the world as well. So we're doing pretty well.
What'd you get out of that 3 months working at that level?
Well, first off is, you get to meet a lot of people in powerful places and positions, and more importantly, they get to know who you are. And, you know, when you're dealing with, say, a rights-based agenda and you're trying to make changes that have international effect, knowing people and having contact with people is a big part of that. So I think that's the first thing that during that time, meeting with representatives from many, many different state and territory governments, I received invitations to go to China to talk at conferences. I received invitations and I went to Taiwan to talk at conferences on climate change. I was invited to Bolivia to talk at conferences with the South American countries and so on. So that... that is something that's very powerful in that sense. A, it allows us to get our messages out about what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are doing and what all that's about. But B, it also means that you get to know who are decision makers, who are the people who influence what happens on the global scale and particularly at the United Nations level. But most importantly, and the reason that Congress agreed and committed to that process was that we get to have influence over the decisions that are adopted by the General Assembly. In this case, the one that was most important was that resolution of 40 paragraphs. We have a lot of influence in terms of what's in each one of those paragraphs and what actions should be taken. And since then, we've been involved in further meetings about specific actions. So to give you an example, the UN has undertaken to revise certain mechanisms that it has to make those mechanisms more effective in having the rights of Indigenous peoples implemented within the countries. And there's some discussions going on at the moment that Congress is engaged with as to how those make those mechanisms more effective. So there's a lot to be gained there, and we keep it in the context of we talk to the government of Australia, but we're not bound and controlled by the government of Australia. If the Australian government doesn't play ball, we are also talking to the international community, and what rights we can't get recognised and conferred through the Australian government, well, we have a right to go and ask for those rights to be recognised and conferred internationally. So I think it gives some sort of a balance to our relationship. Instead of being wards of the state, we are in fact legitimate peoples representing ourselves in the discussions with the Australian government.
Les, I sense or get a feeling that there's, in relation to Congress, there's some of our mob that's sort of a bit too bob each way-ish or a bit critical, similar to the constitutional recognition. There are people against it, there are people in favour of it. And with the Congress, there are our mob out there that don't understand fully or aren't all that supportive. What are some of the reasons? What do you see? I mean, it's the only body we have where our mob elect, have the elections and elect their own people, their own representatives. But what are some of the other things that might encourage people, the reasons why people should engage and become members, because that's important. If you can double that membership figures, I mean, it starts to look pretty really impressive, you know?
Yes, definitely. And I think you've touched on a few important issues there, Tiger. The first thing is that our mob are rightfully cynical about anything that happens, and particularly anything that happens that talks about this is a new way for Aboriginal people or a new direction and so on. And the tendency of our people is to say, well, we'll just sit back and we'll wait and see what happens here, see if it's worthwhile or not. Now, we inherited a space left by ATSIC, and when ATSIC went, you know that there are a lot of people who are criticising ATSIC, we don't want ATSIC, it was no good for us, and so on. But in the time since then, people are saying, you know, it's all got worse since ATSIC, it was the best thing we had going for us, and there are a lot of positive things about it. So it's a little bit of that doubting Thomas approach that our people have. And that's not a thing to be criticised, because our people are not hierarchical. We don't believe in people who have a right to lead or a right to power or anything like that. We're very egalitarian under our own ways that were there traditionally with our laws and so on. We didn't have chiefs or royalty as such. So the cynicism is there, it's there, it's healthy, and it should be tested. But one of the problems we had when Congress was formed and we were building up the organisation, and I came on as the first elected co-chair, was that people kept on criticising us for being a government construct and a government organisation. And we've gone to great lengths to try and say that is not the case. We're a company owned and operated by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. Nobody can close us down except ourselves. Nobody can tell us what to do or restructure us or do anything except ourselves. So we're different from ATSIC. We're different from the National Aboriginal Congress before that. We're different from the National Aboriginal Consultative Committee that started under Whitlam government and so on. We are owned and operated by our own mob, not by the government. That's so important. But then people will say, oh, yeah, well, they still have to pay you to operate and therefore you're dependent. We said, well, that doesn't step us out from all the other organisations in Australia. Everybody has dependency somewhere. The fact is we don't have our own source of wealth at this stage that entitles us to operate independently. But the funding that we do receive, or we have previously received from government, has been without the ties to it. We don't accept the control. And then there's also the fact that we fundraise and we can operate independently and so on. So there's a lot to the fact of our independence. But then groups, the next argument that we encounter is people saying, well, we don't believe in a national body. We have our own mob and we only answer to our own mob and so on. And then the question of sovereignty comes up in that context and so on. But the point is there that those arguments aren't strongly founded. That is that there aren't other organisations that people say represent them. You can't find them. There aren't other forms of sovereignty that's being exercised in this country. People are right to claim that sovereignty was never ceded, are right to claim that we have a right to our own independence and our own say-so, but those structures aren't there. They're not visible. And this is where we're saying people should join Congress and make Congress what they want it to be. If they want it to be an advisor to government, and we strongly are resisting that, then they can make it to be an advisor to government. But if they want it to be a body fighting for their independence, for their self-determination, for greater autonomy and political power and so on, then they make Congress work that way. And that's the push that we've received so far. People are saying, yes, we want you to get there, to be independent, to not just serve to advise government on their policies and so on, but to put decision-making back into the communities. So we have to, we try and sell that message, but it's very hard to reach our mob in the one go. You know, to have a coverage all across Australia, across 500,000 people in hundreds and hundreds of small communities and so on. There are people out there still saying they've never heard of Congress, and that's fair enough. But our challenge is to just keep at it and keep at it, and to win support with our successes. And we've had a few successes along the way so far. We're still working on things which we know are going to be successful, but we think that we're bringing home the goods and people will see that over a period of time.
All right. You've got a new director recently appointed.
Yes. We have a board of 8 people. Two of those co-chairs, myself and Kirsty Parker, were elected directly by all the membership, but the other 6 board members are elected from their chambers, Chamber 1, Chamber 2 or Chamber 3. I won't go into details explaining those. Tammy Solonek was representing Chamber 3 as one of the 2 co-chairs, and she has recently joined Amnesty International and is working with them on quite a good, effective national program for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and has decided to resign from the board to concentrate on that amnesty work. So we had a by-election, and Amala Groom has been successful in winning that election, and Amara will attend her first board meeting in about 2 weeks' time to meet with the Congress board. We've already had discussions with her to tell her where we're at and what we're focusing on at the moment and so on. Amara might not be well known to a lot of people, and particularly listeners in Queensland, because she's been mainly in New South Wales and some time in the Northern Territory. So she doesn't have a national profile as such. But it'll be interesting having Amara on board. And Amara will serve out the remainder of the term of Tammy Solonik, which means the next elections that come up for the board, Amara will have to retire from the position and stand again to get that thing. But we wish Amara the best on that. Her profile will be on our website if people want to look and find more about Amara. And I suppose it's an opportunity for me to plug also that because of gender equity in our organisation, we have 4 men, 4 women that serve on our board to ensure that it's not dominated by men. As tend to be the process in the political organisations.
All right. Talking about gender balance, the results of the recent Queensland elections has seen a massive turnaround by the Labor Party take control of government, even though it be a minority situation. But the cabinet is made up of more women than men, first time in history, and we've got 2 First Nations people, one of whom is a cabinet member.
That's an excellent result, and it's interesting to see what goes on. We, as Congress, we try not to lean in relation to Australian politics one way or another. We try to be non-partisan as such. But it was quite clear that the public reacts when a government no longer thinks that it is put there by the people, that it, in fact, is an authority in its own right. And we're seeing more and more in Australia now about the political representatives becoming more elite and more insulated or isolated from the public and the public will. And I think, you know, the results in Queensland were amazing. I felt that even if there hadn't been a change of government, the voter backlash meant that there would be a change in the political style of the Queensland government one way or another anyway. And we've got more elections coming in New South Wales in a few months' time, and then we've, of course, got things going on the national level with political unrest and so on. So but one of the challenges for an organisation like Congress is to survive all political styles and, you know, what goes on and all and so on. So we'll be making contact with the representatives in the Queensland government, both the Premier and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander representatives that are now in the government, as we did with the Northern Territory government, Adam Giles and his team and so on, to talk about what we do as a rights-based organisation and how we interact with the parliaments which represent the Australian population. We want decision-making by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to be in that process.
All right. Well, is there anything else you want to add in winding up?
No, there's a lot of things going on. I should add that 2015, we've targeted this year to be a particularly active one for us now. It's actually the 4th year of Congress as an elected organisation. And we see we're building up at the moment to have a good, strong run during the middle of the year and towards the end of the year, including having some. We're looking at having a national day of protest. We'll talk more about that a little bit later, but we think that there's a real desire for people to be heard now on the street about things, and so we want to try and coordinate that so that it's clear what message is going across to government, particularly about budgeting and so on, and to give people an opportunity around the countryside to demonstrate the fact that they're not happy with the way that things are going. And then we've got our National Congress meeting scheduled at the end of this year, which is when we'll bring our delegates together. We're hoping to have a big conference around that open to the public, including with international visitors coming to that as well. So people who are on the world stage and who are part of making a difference in the human rights area, we hope to make a big event of that towards the end of the year.
Well, we'll be talking some more before then, so we'll get more updates. But look, thanks for your time today. We certainly appreciate having you with us and giving us the updates.
Yep, thanks, Doug.
Thank you, Les. You have a good one.
Bye.
Les Melzer, co-chair of the Congress for Australia, National Congress for Australia's First Peoples.